Hello? Hello?
Guess someone's there. Cooper, I'm on class. Class one.
Hello.
Hello, this is Jordan West.
Hi, Lynn Beginsky in Denver.
Who is this?
Lynn Beginsky in Denver.
Oh. Hi, Lynn.
How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I'm calling from Anderson, South Carolina.
Anderson, South Carolina. Nice place.
The state of champions.
It is indeed the state of champions. Very
yeah.
good.
So how are things in Denver?
They're good. Things are nice. It's about 60 degrees outside, sunny. Pretty
wow.
good.
That's great for Denver.
Yeah, if it didn't have a chilly breeze, I'd be out playing golf, but the breeze is kind of cool, so. I'll wait a few more weeks.
Yeah, okay. You hadn't been out to Colorado in a few years.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a nice place. South Carolina's
yeah.
a nice place. I have friends that live in Greenville. They love it.
Oh, well, I'm about 30 miles south of Greenville. Yeah, it's a nice area.
Very nice, yeah.
Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. I hope you're all doing great. What kind of thoughts or questions or reflections do you have from the first seminar and from reviewing the outline and the exercises that I hope you've had a chance to look at? What would be most helpful to talk about?
Well, I found, this is Lynn in Denver.
Lynn, hi, welcome.
Thank you. You know, it made it apparent that really getting well organized is key. And, you know, having an outline of how to do it, you know, like title page, I've got about, or cover, you know, picking the cover, I've got like three choices. Picking the write-up for the cover, making those choices, and making them firm and not always wavering on them and going back and changing my mind, but really trying to get connected with my deeper self and choosing what I'm going to use and then sticking with it.
I think you have mentioned a couple of important things that I want to just highlight for everyone, and I appreciate you saying that. And one is structure gives us freedom, because once you have the structure in place, you don't have to spend the energy wondering about will you or won't you, do you or don't you, but you have the structure.
Exactly.
So that you immerse yourself fully in doing it, and you don't have any energy on the boundaries or any boundary skirmishes. Another is you describe a particular way of making a decision. If we look at a decision-making process, there's a continuum. On one end, can I get a management of the background noise? I'm hearing, and we're hearing, static. If you're making any movement or doing papers or anything with your phone, it's picking it up.
Okay, I was moving the paper.
One way of making a decision is to do all of the due diligence, do all the research, and then once you make a decision, to continue to do all of that research to be sure you've made the right decision, to continue looking at the options, the possibilities. Another, at the opposite end of this continuum at least, to do all of that research, due diligence, make the decision, and then immerse yourself fully in making that become the right decision. And
mm-hmm.
that inevitably is going to work better because you then put your energy into bringing it about and to fulfilling the goal and all of the things that you've decided to do. So what you described, I think, is an excellent way of making a decision and then getting immersed in the pursuit of it with the structure and putting all of your effort into the fruition of it.
And, you know, I spent so much yeah, I spend so much time rewriting, and it's like ridiculous. It's just because it's never the same, and it's one is necessarily not better than the other. It's just that, you know, I have to just let it go and use what I have and be confident in it, and knowing that the other stuff I can do another book or whatever at a later date.
That's a good point. You know, most of writing is rewriting, but then at some point you have to pull the trigger and say, okay, this is where it is. This is enough, and it's not going to be perfect, but this is what I do, and you move on, and you'll know the difference between dosing and timing and titrating that from compromising or procrastination.
Right.
So I think those are excellent points. Who else? What other thoughts or questions or things that might be helpful for all of us to talk about for a moment before we move into the topic? Any questions that have come up as you've looked at the exercises, hopefully done some of them, and looking at applying what we talked about last seminar?
No, pretty clear.
Okay, I want to ask each of you a question. Jot down your answer to these four questions. What initially draws us into a story we want to hear or read? Just one word or phrase, jot it down. Second question, what sustains our engagement as a listener or reader? First impression, word or phrase. Three, what do we unconsciously respond to when we hear or read a story that really captures our attention? What is it about that story? Again, first impression, word or phrase. And four, what determines bestsellers from non-sellers? Okay, I'm going to go on to lecture mode, and I want to come back to these questions, then I'm going to tell you why I'm coming back to these questions at a point in our seminar this evening. Okay, we're in presentation mode, and we're talking about, in this seminar, the craft of writing. And you see the quote that I included in the outline from Mark Twain. Writing is easy. All you have to do is cross out the wrong words. So that makes it easy. You learn to do something by doing it. Writing is no different. You learn to write by producing a certain number of words on a regular basis. You learn to become an author by rewriting. So here are some reflections as we think about the craft of writing and the idea that you are author not only of your life story, but also your written story. What do you do uniquely well, better than anybody else? Who's your audience? Now, this is in your outline, so you don't have to take notes, but you kind of reflect as we're talking about. In setting your writing goals, be really clear about three things: what your readers need from you, what you want to offer them, and what things you understand that you really want to convey to the reader. Now, back to the questions that I ask. What initially draws us into a story, sustains our engagement, what do we respond to when we really have a story that captures our attention, what determines bestsellers from non-sellers? There's one answer to all of these questions. It comes from neuroscience. It's based on how our brains are wired to perceive and process stories. The story's secret is this: from the first sentence, we must want to know what happens next. When we want to know what happens next, the brain's pleasure center of dopamine fires, and it signals that intriguing information is unfolding. We pay attention, and we keep going. A story's hardwired in our brains. It's how we strategically make sense of an otherwise confusing or overwhelming world. So when a story meets these hardwired expectations, it engages and becomes successful. So the question is, what sustains the listener or reader's efforts? Or the clients. This is what is so important, to look at what will happen next to sustain engagement and interest. I have heard two agents and two different publishers put it in a very simple way. One agent and two publishers said, I can tell by the end of the first page whether I'm going to go with a book or not. One agent said, first paragraph. They know from the beginning. They can tell. So this is something to keep in mind about being wired for a successful story. Now, I'll tell you the reason that I held off a little bit and ask you a question, because a question focuses the energy field of your brain, as you know that from coaching. And if how many of you know what the Zeigarnik effect is? I only see a show of hands from those of you who have read my blog. I have a blog on the Zeigarnik effect. Let me tell you just very quickly, because this is something that is important in terms of how our minds and brains work. This is important to me because my psychoanalytic grandfather was Kurt Lewin, the founder of social psychology. And when you do psychoanalytic training, you kind of have curiosity about who analyzed your analyst, and Kurt Lewin analyzed my analyst. Well, one day at lunch, Kurt Lewin and Dr. Bluma Zeigarnik, this was in 1926, they were having lunch, and on a whim, Lewin asked the waiter how much the bill was, and he told him. And then about 5 minutes later, he asked him again how much the bill was, and he had no idea. And the colleague, Dr. Zeigarnik, and he were curious about this because they knew that once there is a closure, once we have a closure of our mind and brain, we stop processing things. If there's not a closure, it keeps it open for curiosity, which is why you probably know from the beginning of a presentation or any kind of engagement, you get someone's curiosity. You ask questions. You get them engaged and to focus with you to look at and be curious about taking in new information. So this is why I asked you and wanted to wait a while, so that it would kind of marinate a bit, so you'd be curious about it. And I mention that because many authors began books that way, they began stories that way, by engaging questions. They engage a story that really raises and crystallizes a question. So now let's look at understanding your motivation for publishing. There are 12 and counting reasons. People want to write for a bunch of different reasons. So here are some of them. To disseminate your knowledge, experience, and message to readers. As a gift to clients. As a premium with some offer, like an ebook, or as a bonus for subscribing to a newsletter. To publish with a traditional house using an agent to establish a national or international presence as an author. To make money by selling the book yourself. To use your book to make money for other services and products. Now, the reason I'm mentioning these, and we're still in the end counting, is to think about what you want to do with your book, because it makes a difference from the beginning about how you think you want to publish it. It makes a difference where you want to end up, much like coaching. Where do you want to get to? Then we back into it once you have the vision of what you want to do with it. You back into it, and it makes the strategy and the story of it much easier. To use your book to make money for other services and products. To establish yourself as an expert. Now, these reasons are not mutually exclusive. To enhance your client base. As a springboard for seminars, workshops, presentations, and retreats. To develop mastermind groups or discussion groups based on your book. To make a difference in people's lives. In our own small way, we each want to change the world. Here's how Tom Stoppard, one of my favorite playwrights, put it. Words are sacred. They deserve respect. If you get the right ones in the right order, you can nudge the world a little. Or finally, to leave a legacy. Here's how the dedication of one such book, A Memoir on Parenting, sounds. To Ryan and Lauren, I hope there will be a time when you will find at least some of this book interesting, though if I've done a good job of parenting, not revealing anything new. I can't know whether or if it will be tomorrow or a dozen years of tomorrows from now. Know that whenever it is, I will be loving you. May you walk through all your days with love remembered and love renewed. Dad. That was my dedication from Making Memories. I'm going to use this later as an example of one publishing option. So I want to talk a little bit about voice now. It's kind of an elusive concept, and I think I can make it really simple and something that you can grasp and use. Definite voice is conversational voice. The writer gives us a sense that we're listening to an empathic storyteller, a skilled raconteur, rather than simply looking at words on paper. Now, this is different from the simple advice you may hear, write the way you talk. Voice involves more than accurate transcription. A true essence of conversation comes from attentive listening and dedicated revision. There are some samples of voice at the back of the workbook exercises that you downloaded, beginning with the outline. Those are some from my favorite authors, because you probably have recognized this. When you have favorite authors, when you have a favorite author whose voice you know, you can read a sentence or two anywhere in any context and know it's that person. That's voice. Now, transcribing talk is not writing, but it's one technique to help cultivate voice. Some writers speak into recording devices to let their voices flow and hear themselves think at the same time, which is exactly what I do, as I mentioned. One step in your editing process, then, after it's transcribed, is to read your words out loud so you can recast a word or sentence that doesn't sound quite right. Barbara McClintock, who was awarded a Nobel Prize for her study of gene transposition in corn plants, said that she made her discoveries by listening to what the corn told her. She described respecting the life and presence of the corn and, as she put it, letting it come. She said she learned the stories of the plants. She heard them. She watched their daily green journeys of growth and came to know the plants in the way a healer or mystic would have known them from the inside, by hearing the inner voice of corn speaking to her as another being. Now, just as an aside, even in previously contributing to the psychoanalytic literature on empathy as a scientific way of listening, it never occurred to me that an ear of corn had much to say. I suspect that if I mused out loud to a colleague that some vegetables were talking to me, well, you know what would happen next. For Barbara, though, it was a true exchange. From the perspective of voice, consider this short passage. I think you'll hear it immediately. I use this passage, which also fits my philosophy of coaching, as a preface for my last book written as a psychoanalyst, Integrating Body, Self, and Psychological Self. It's from Anatoly Broillard's Intoxicated by My Illness. And this is how he put it. My ideal doctor, I can imagine entering my condition, looking around it from the inside like an ideal landlord with a tenant, trying to see how he could make the premises more livable. He would look around, holding me by the hand, and he would figure out what it is like to be me. Then he would try to find certain advantages in the situation. He can turn disadvantages into advantages. He would see the genius of my illness. He would mingle his demon with mine. We would wrestle with my fate together like Rupert and Birkin in the library and D.H. Lawrence's Women in Love. I would also like a doctor who enjoyed me. I want to be a good story for him, to give some of my art in exchange for his. Let's talk about designing every part of your book. This seminar is about the craft of writing, and I want to look at that from as many perspectives as I think it might be helpful for you to get a real purchase on this. Now, we're going to revisit the first two in a moment in the book outline, but the first two, the title, 5 words or less that tells and sells. I'll tell you why in just a bit. The subtitle, the promise, the benefits described. The subtitle should tell the reader what that reader will get as a benefit from reading that book. And you probably are familiar with this in so many ways from so many books. An example, the subtitle of The Secret Language of Money, How to Make Smarter Financial Decisions and Live a Richer Life. The third, after title and subtitle, The Silver Bullet, a clear, sharply focused description of your book that can be recited in a very brief sentence or two. It should clearly explain what your book is about, why it's special, and the benefits it will provide to readers. Remember, the burden of clarity and simplicity is yours. The mission statement is a 10-word or less statement of the purpose of your book. And one idea is to write the back cover before you write your book. It's a compelling ad copy explaining the benefits and the applications to the reader. The book introduction, the problem you address for your audience, why you wrote the book, its purpose, its benefits, and how you're going to present it. Think about how when you go to pick up a book in a bookstore, you may read, especially if it's written by the author, the preface or the introduction. It may be short, it may be only a couple of pages, but that's kind of like the sample session, or kind of like the sample when you go into Baskin-Robbins. You get an idea of what it's going to be like to go on this journey with this person. It's not the journey, but you get a sample, an idea of what it's like. You get the flavor of it, and it determines if you are really going to embark together on this journey with this person. Next, a table of contents, and then a book outline. I have a structure for that book outline that's compiled by some books that I respect very much, and you see that there are two referenced at the end of the outline for this session. And then the query letter, finally. The lead, the body, the bio, and the close. Even if you don't plan to use an agent, I think it'll help you conceptualize an overview and intended impact of your book to do a query letter. So let's look now, expand this, the nonfiction book proposal. First, why is this important? Even if you don't plan to submit it to a traditional publishing house, why is it important? The book proposal is the business plan of your book. It's the structure. An architect needs a blueprint. This is the blueprint of your book. You need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. You know from coaching, setting a goal is going to enhance motivation. Establishing strategies can help facilitate focus. If you don't know where you're going, any map will do. So, you should have an end in mind from the beginning. Now, Lewis Carroll put this really well. Alice came to a fork in the road. Which road do I take, she asked. Where do you want to go, asked the Cheshire Cat. I don't know, Alice answered. Then said the cat, it doesn't matter. Develop an organizing idea with a substantial center. What's your book about? Why does it exist? You'll communicate both of these notions again and again in various ways throughout your book. The title, the subtitle, the headline sentences, the chapter subtitles all fit a brand, the essence of your book. The nonfiction book proposal is a tool to help you organize and elaborate your concept of a book. Another purpose of the proposal maybe to tell a publisher about your book, why it's important, why you're the one to write it, and why it will be successful. A good book starts with a good idea. The book's merit should address these five primary issues. Why would somebody want to read your book? Who is the target audience? What is your unique hook? Can the hook and the message support an entire book? And what will I be telling my readers that they don't already know? So let's look at the components of the book proposal. And again, even if you're not submitting it to an agent or a traditional publisher, this is useful because these are the bones of the structure of your book. This is the blueprint of the architecture of your book. One, and this is all in your outline, one, title and subtitle. Now, the reason I say a title, but what we know from neuroscience, a title should contain no more than five words. The reason that a longer title requires the reader to think instead of feel. A title should create a motivating visualization. We know that many more people think in pictures and learn in a visual way rather than learn in an auditory or kinesthetic way. So you want something more visual. You want it to make to be a decision point from their right brain, not a bunch of stuff you have to think about and move over to your left brain and look at logically. The title should trigger positive images, not negative ones. Its focus should also be positive rather than negative, not even the avoidance of a negative. And remember, neuroscience tells us we get what we focus on, not what we want. The title should pass the airplane test. Now, this is my personally devised test that occurred to me spontaneously when a publisher asked me to write a blurb for the dust jacket of a book. And I said, well, sure, I'll be happy to. We were talking on the phone. And I asked him, what was the book's title? And he told me. And I said, I'll be happy to review the book if it had a different title, but that one doesn't pass the airplane test. And he said, okay, Dave, what's the airplane test? And I said, if I'm on an airplane and somebody sees the book I'm reading, I don't want to be embarrassed by its title or feel stupid to be reading it or have somebody wonder if I have the pathology that the title promises will fix. He thanked me, had the author change the title, sent me a nice bound galley to review. It made bestseller. Now, I also have a subtest for titles that may pass the economy class test, but aren't quite ready for the first class. You know, an example may be the Madoff Investment Guide. Now, and there are exceptions to everything. Here's one exception to the rule of five words or less for a title. It's a bestseller by child and adolescent psychologist Dr. Anthony Wolfe. Here's the title. Get out of my life, but first could you drop me and Cheryl off at the mall? Great book on adolescence. Two, the overview. A compelling overview of your book, one or two pages in length, should communicate what your book is about and show the essential worth and marketability of the book and show how it's not just a magazine article or newspaper story. The overview should be a clear, concise statement that includes four components at least: what the book is about, why it should be written, how you're going to write it, and why you're the best person to do it. Remember, this is all in your outline. Three, markets. The section should contain information, because this is some of the research you need to do, about what the markets are, who will buy the book, who you're writing it for, why the book should exist, and your strategy to sell it. Four, the competition. The competition section spells out the results of your research and assessment as to how viable your proposal is, the competition, any complementary books, and how you support the idea of the book's existence. Five, promotion. And this is huge. However you publish, even if you do traditional publishing with a well-known publishing house through an agent, they still want you to come with a significant platform, the number of people who do a following of you who are going to buy your book. And whatever kind of publishing you do, and we'll go over nine or ten different ways to publish your book, whatever you do, the promotion is important, so your platform is important. And we'll come back to that in a moment. So the promotion is what you will do to help promote and sell your book, or if you're publishing yourself, it'll totally be on you. With some of these points, maybe regional and national presentations, perhaps a publicist, a faculty or consultant position with network promotion, memberships with marketing impact, electronic and regular mail contacts, collaborative promotional and affiliate partners, that's huge. When I released The Secret Language of Money, McGraw-Hill, a very traditional publisher, coordinated all of their efforts and all of my efforts with affiliate partners and their lists, all of my people with my lists, their people with their lists, so that the day of release, there was an email in 1,230,000 email boxes about the book. When you look at affiliate partners who have 10, 20, 50, 100,000 on their list, it can mount up pretty quickly. Interviews for the book release and articles that you have, blogs especially. When I did the release for Secret Language of Money, McGraw-Hill nudged me to do a blog, which I didn't do at the time. And some of you have heard this before. I had a newsletter that I had worked on and had a really nice following, had a couple of white papers that I periodically changed out for people to get when they signed on, and I had a very nice subscription base for my newsletter. It took me 4 months to get as many subscribers for my blog as it took 4.5 years for the newsletter. Blogs can go viral. They can be something that are used by blog search engines. There's a whole realm of possibility for blogs. You can go to other people's blogs, comment. We'll return to that because I think that's an important aspect. Six, the author's background. This is the aspect of the book outline that we're talking about now. Number six, the author's background. Emphasize your background and experience as it relates to the book. That's what's important. Seven, the chapter outline. Now, this section, its organization and persuasion, is crucial. It should contain a table of contents and a chapter-by-chapter outline with chapter abstracts, a synopsis of each chapter. It can be as little as two or three paragraphs, maybe up to a page each. But think about how once you have written the book outline, this chapter outline, and the abstract for each of the chapters, that is a significant portion of your writing of that book. These chapter abstracts allow you to show what you can do without having to write the book. It's the blueprint for your book. If you want to submit a book proposal to a publisher for a nonfiction book, all you have is the book outline and a sample chapter. But the book outline is going to be the essence of the book. So you've done much of the thinking and the planning and the organizing for the book by the time you've done the book outline. I know a number of authors who spend about a third to a half of the time they do on the book on the outline because they're home free. Once they have the outline, they just work on filling it in. Eight, the sample chapter. Now, the sample chapter, usually chapter one, simply proves that you can do the job. So, the chapter abstracts, the blueprint for the book, chapter one, to show how you're going to be writing the book. Engage the reader from the first sentence. Look at some recent nonfiction bestsellers. As I mentioned last time, chapter one in every book begins with a story, a powerful story that engages the reader captures the essence of the book's message and raises questions that will then unfold and be answered throughout the remainder of the book. Now, a nonfiction book proposal usually runs somewhere between 20 to 40 pages plus a sample chapter. Now, the book proposal is not just a sales tool for the writer, it's an essential teaching tool for the writer. It's your game plan, your superstructure. This book proposal serves as a map for you because it requires you to understand the meaning of your book and articulate what the book is about. It requires you to think about why you're the person to write it and why anybody would be interested in it. These are the demands you should already be placing on yourself when you first consider writing a book. In fact, the first month or two of creating your book may be about investigating your idea and beginning to write your book proposal. So, I want to move more into the how-to and the what-to-do in terms of the craft of writing a book. I want to talk about the 7 habits of successful writers. 1. Create a specific plan, including your schedule for writing. Stick with it no matter what. Sometimes one of the most important things in life, as well as writing, is to show up, have a plan, and stick to it. Now, this schedule is simply a writing plan. It doesn't have to be detailed or onerous, but it could look any way that fits your biorhythms, that fits your schedule, your structure. You know, some examples. I'll write for 2 hours, 5 days a week, between 8 and 10 p.m. Another, I will draft 500 words of writing each day, 5 days a week. I will create 2 chunks a week. We're going to come back to that. I'll create an outline of the book by fill in the date. I will create an annotated outline by fill in the blank. Focusing on a specific, simple action sets up the best potential for your effectiveness and mastery. Divide up your work. Focus on and complete one thing at a time. There's always something you can focus on. During my specialty training in psychiatry, one of my first-year supervisors had a really puzzling picture on the wall. It was a photograph in which everything seemed curiously out of focus. As I met with him each week, I'd glance at the photograph. Finally, toward the end of the year, this was like 11 months into the weekly supervision meeting with him, I finally asked him about it. And he said, "Well, look carefully, Dave. What do you see?" Well, I walked over to the photograph to get a closer look. Closer didn't help. It still seemed out of focus. I saw no particular aesthetic value. I had experience and considerable interest in photography, but that didn't help. And I finally said, "Steve, the only thing I notice, there's only one branch of one tree in focus in the entire picture." And I looked at him and expected he might chuckle, but he nodded. He said, "That's why I have it hanging there. It's my reminder that while things may seem confusing and blurry, there's always at least one thing that you can have in focus and see clearly." Which is why he was a great supervisor for first-year residents. 2, when you write, write. Don't combine writing and editing. 2 different mindsets, 2 different parts of the brain. You can't do both at the same time. It takes too much energy to go back and forth. Plan separate times for each task. Enter that state of mind and sustain it. 3rd habit of successful writers. Take one step at a time. Have a small, specific, definable goal. Write in small bursts. The first draft may be done at various times, bit by bit, and may be a compilation of several stacks of pages from various times. I know a few of you have heard this story from me. Terry Fox ran the Marathon of Hope. It's a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Because he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop. He managed about 24 miles a day, completed the run in 143 days. He was interviewed immediately after the race and asked, How did he keep going when he was exhausted and knew he had thousands of miles ahead? And he responded simply, I just kept running to the next telephone pole. 4, find your most efficient way of writing and stick to it. Whether it's the computer, writing longhand on a yellow pad, dictating for later transcription, do what your learning and creativity style informs you as most effective. Also, pay attention to your biorhythms, your best time of the day for creative writing, the time of the day for more objective work of editing. You know, so when you pay attention to your biorhythms, it's analogous to, in Texas, we say, it's easier to ride a horse in the direction he's going. 5, read your work aloud. This can be a very effective way of editing. It's a way of listening at another level. If possible, and I think this is really helpful, join a writer's group to hear your work and other work read by others. Most of the writing groups, the ones that I've done, will you bring a piece of writing and somebody else reads it. So therefore, you can't, you know, interrupt and say, oh, you need to pause there. You hear it as a reader will read it. So you all get the same objectivity. And then you discuss it, and it can be a powerful process. 6, do adequate research. Effective writers know that good research is about pursuing questions and information of themselves as well as resorting to books, websites, reports, and interviews. One way to get new information, this is one of the primary ways that I keep abreast of what's happening in the world, from journal articles to research labs to the popular press, is to do Google Alerts. I have a couple of dozen Google Alerts that come to me once a day. You just Google Alerts and put in what you want to be alerted to. If it's more than one word, remember to put it in quotes. You know, behavioral economics. Put it in quotes so that you get anything in the world literature about behavioral economics. And this is also how your blogs will be dispersed, because what you'll also see included in the daily email of the title and a little abstract and the link to whatever you're searching will be blogs of that title. So as you have an awareness of search engine optimization of your blogs, that will get dispersed too. That's how they go viral. And what a method that I use for efficiency is anything that I see that I may want to look at, I'll click on the link, and if it looks like an interesting article, I'll copy it and stack it, and when I get to a place where, you know, during the week or during the month, I'll go through that stack and dictate from it so that it's very efficient. I don't intersperse reading an article with all the other things I'm doing during the day. 7, read the writing of others. We learn by reading. Read what instructs as well as what stimulates. Read from other related fields. Stretch yourself. You'll find your own best balance of reading and writing. Now, these are, in my view, the top 6 mistakes successful writers avoid. And this is a range of stuff. 1, avoid passive sentence construction. As you reread and edit your work, convert passive verbs into active language wherever possible. 2, strive to be the 4 rules of good writing, William Zinsser, The Art of Writing. Also, by the way, the 4 rules of good speaking. Clear, specific, simple, and humane. Those 4 rules of good writing, clarity, brevity, simplicity, humanity. Don't shift the clarity of communication to the listener or reader. Keep the burden of the clarity yourself. This will make you a more effective speaker and writer. 3, show, don't tell your audience. Use stories, metaphors. Combining a good story, right brain, with pointing out the story's lesson, left brain, engages both sides of the brain for balanced learning. People accept more ideas when their minds are in story mode as opposed to a more analytical mindset. Show, don't tell. Melville didn't write a story about whaling. He wrote a unique action and dialogue drama between one guy and one fish. Stories are how we understand and how we remember. James Watson, the scientist who with Crick discovered DNA, said, "You know, I can remember something when I fit it into a story." That's how our brains are constructed. Our stories are wired to seek patterns. A story makes things make sense. Lawyers know this. Little kids standing next to broken vases know this. Muriel Rukeyser said, "The world is made up of stories, not atoms." 4, keep the I to a minimum in order to acknowledge and engage your reader. 5, lose the jargon and the fancy phrases. Hemingway believed that 1 to 2 syllable words work better than longer ones. Don't seek to impress your audience with your intellect, vocabulary, or research. Your reader wants a savvy friend who explains things in a down-to-earth way, who also happens to be an expert. 6, this is huge. Be a good storyteller. When you carefully craft a speech or tell a story, the art lies in evoking the desired emotional response from the listener or reader. Rather than expressing yourself or telling what the receiver's reaction should be, you enable the reader to have the emotional experience. You give the feeling to the reader or the listener. We can learn from the poets who offer their art to the reader or listener as a doorway to their own experience. Now, this is a reiteration. I touched on this in the discussion last time. One of the storytellers I studied with told of an experience he had going through the airport in Chicago. A woman stopped him, remember, to say how much she enjoyed his presentation and say how it had stayed with her for 4 years. He asked her to remind him what he had talked about. She said, "Oh, I don't remember what you talked about, but I always remember that story you told." Now, here's some homework, some chunking exercises. This is in your outline. A chunk. It's a literary word. A piece of writing about the size of a newspaper column that looks at a single subject. So exercise 1 would be to write a single chunk. Treat the single subject in a complete self-contained way, like a newspaper article. And any story has a beginning, middle, and end. A challenge, a struggle, a resolution. This might be an anecdote, a vignette, an exercise, a description of an event, a complete thought, or a case study. It should be on the subject related to your book. And if you convert it to copy, to typed copy, you put it in a folder on your computer. So you're already beginning to accumulate stuff. Exercise 2, write 4 more chunks. And you'll see that chunks are the building blocks of nonfiction books. You'll begin to think in chunks. You'll begin to think about an anecdote, a vignette, an exercise, an event, an illustration. You'll begin to see how it fits into your book or how it illustrates something. 3rd exercise, fit your chunks into your outline. See what the chunks illuminate or describe to further a section of a specific chapter of your book. Exercise 4, plan a month of writing. After you've written 5 chunks and fitted them into the outline, you may want to revise your outline. After revision, decide what chunks to write next. Some of these may be spontaneous. You're going to come upon something or encounter something, but some you can plan. For these, you'll be more aware of what you want to write, and you can create a writing schedule around this. So here are, and I want to conclude with this, some important areas of focus for the serious writer. And this is, again, to elaborate the craft of writing. 1 is the mission statement of your book. Now, in business, a mission statement is a statement of an organization's primary purpose, the strategies to achieve that purpose, and its fundamental values. A personal mission statement can clarify and give meaning to your daily activities. It adds focus and commitment to what you do. So, consider the mission statement for your book. A mission statement contains four elements: ideals, purpose, strategies, and goals. The ideals, the core values that motivate and guide you, defining the important element of what you're going to convey in the book. Two, purpose. What you want to accomplish, the benefits the reader is going to get, are consistent with the ideals that you have. Third, strategy, the art and science of a plan of action. This has to do with how you will conceive, craft, and deliver your book. And finally, goals. Effective goals are SMART goals: specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, time-bound. Create a mission statement for yourself as a writer. It can guide you. It can remind you what you are meant to do. This can become a compass to guide your story completion and fulfillment. Write it down. Look at it each time before you begin writing. Some other important areas of focus for the serious writer. Two, a business plan for your book. This is the book proposal, the business plan. Three, a timetable, a calendar of completion of each aspect of your book. And remember, we were talking with Lynn at the beginning of this seminar about how structure really gives you freedom. Four, a daily schedule, if not daily, weekly, but to structure that as part of what you do. Five, your writing space, the space of your own, as Virginia Woolf emphasized. Six, your tools, adequate support, computer, maybe business stationery and cards, books, references, magazines related to your writing. Seven, continuing education in writing in your subject matter and including in marketing, because this is going to be a part of what you do. This can be from Google Alerts. This can be from other sources. Eight, a writer's group. Some of the huge leaps forward I made came from attending a couple of writers' groups at the University of Iowa. In them, I learned as much from the other participants as I did from the known writer who was coordinating the groups. At a local University of Houston imprint series, we did something I've subsequently incorporated into a boot camp for writers that I conducted. Hearing your writing, as I mentioned, read by someone else. You can't tell the reader where to pause or use a certain inflection. And you'll find that objectively listening to your own work read aloud can be hugely beneficial. So I want to conclude with your belief systems. If you want to change your life, first change your mind. How do you do an inventory of beliefs that may be limiting or compromising your shadow story? Neuroscientists tell us that 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. This is analogous to impressionistic painting. Each of your experiences is a dab of paint on a puntless canvas. Only when you step back and view the entire picture do you recognize the points form a pattern of a particular segment of life, and that the segments have their own unity. You create each experience, the patterns, and the composite image. Each is at a different level of awareness. You're always free to change your mind, always free to change your beliefs and core assumptions about who and what you are. Changing your mind not only alters your brain, but also transforms your life. You know this from coaching and working with other people, perhaps from your own mentor coach. But first you have to be aware. Prediction and expectation based on the past simply create repetition. But when it's based on the present and future, prediction and expectation create possibilities. So, a belief system constructs an obstacle or an opportunity. consider this application in your writing. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. Let me say that a different way. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. We always create the outside to match the inside. The secret here is that an obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. Reminds you what you want, but it makes it safe to want if you're afraid. Let me tell you a brief story to illustrate this. I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash, barking relentlessly at a cat as if to say, just let me at him. Now, the next frame was the cat. And the cat was absolutely as big and as mean looking as the dog. And then in the third frame, the dog was, again, barking ferociously, let me at him. The leash snapped, so the dog was free to go after the cat. It turned back and looked astonished, scared to death, quickly ran back, tied a triple knot, then could again strain safely at the leash and bark as ferocious, just let me at him. Or think about a very simple application. There's a scary part of a movie you don't want to see, so you put your hand over your face, but then you create a little bit of light between two fingers so you can peek through. As long as the obstacle's in place, it's like it's okay to do the desire. So here's the principle, and here's the coaching principle. When you find yourself focusing on the obstacle, for example, I can't find time to write, reflect on the underlying desire. And here's the coaching not so secret. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. So, imagine what it would be like not to create your obstacles. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. We have a few minutes for questions, thoughts, reflections that any of you have about what we talked about. Clarifications or questions about anything? I'm interested in your take on this. Or if there are any questions about the craft of writing that we didn't cover. Yes?
No, that last sentence that you said about the obstacle. So the belief system that creates the obstacle, so then you reframe it so that, I don't know, you get to, I'm always free to change my mind.
Yes. Think about it in this way, in terms of writing a story. Whatever we think and feel and experience is what we create each moment.
Okay.
Whatever experience you have, you either create or you agree to. So if there's an obstacle, the idea is not to overcome or strategize around the obstacle or obliterate it. The idea is to recognize that if the obstacle is there, you've created it. So to consider creating something else instead.
Mm-hmm.
When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. So that then the question simply becomes, what do you put your energy into rather than the obstacle? Because the obstacle takes energy and becomes its own barrier.
Mm-hmm.
So your energy is yours to create, and your belief system determines how you'll do that.
Good.
This is George.
Yes, please.
This is George.
Hey, welcome.
Are you
a question?
Yeah, the question. I have about 200 pieces that I'm writing out of my experience.
I'm sorry, you have 200 what?
I've been writing every day for close to a year.
Okay.
And I have about 200 pieces. There are
200 pages?
Meditation.
Is that the word you're saying?
200 pieces. Short writings.
Oh, okay.
There are, they come out of my experiences working as a chaplain. And there are meditations and reflections. I don't have them in any particular order in terms of themes, but you know, they're their inspirational writings and that type of thing. What tips can you give me in terms of organization?
Well, you can do it one of two ways. You already have a great deal that's written. I would say schedule a time with yourself to read through it all and see what themes you can derive and what kind of overarching principles you can see in what you've written and see if it's something that you want to further develop and go with what you have and see what fits into that. You know, another way would be to have a brainstorming session with yourself to create something more like the beginning of a book outline. What are the themes or what is the idea that you want to pursue, to cue your radar to look for possibilities? And then you're going to begin to see all kinds of things that fit into that. And there's going to be an organization that begins with that conceptualization. You know, it's kind of like once you begin writing about something, you're going to begin to see all sorts of illustrations and ideas and think about things that you want to pursue and, you know, see articles that relate to that. So that's going to become its own organizer. You know, when for example, when McGraw-Hill nudged me, in no uncertain terms, to begin a blog, I did the blog based on the subject area of the book, the psychology, the neuroeconomics of money. And as I began to write about that, I began to see all kinds of things that were bloggable, things that were of particular interest to me, continuing I write about what I most want to learn, and this became part of that at a different level than doing it as a book or as a white paper. Now, what happened is after doing this for a considerable period of time, the material for the blog became almost half of the material for the sequel to The Secret Language of Money. So that kind of organization helped in and of itself. So I would say look at how you want to organize what you're doing so that everything that you do in each of these times that you sit down to write has an informed approach and is organized around something you want to develop, because it's going to help you not only organize, it's going to cue your radar for seeing things that are relevant and that are going to be adding to that. Now, does that make sense to you?
Yes, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, super. Well, we're out of time. If there's anything that we didn't get a chance to cover, jot it down. We'll begin right here next time. So remember to look at the exercises, the work pages that are accompanying your outline, to look at things that you might do in between times, the whole workbook that has exercises and guidelines for what you might do to further your writing. Hopefully it'll be a catalyst in addition to what we're talking about. So have a great week. I look forward to talking to you right here next time.
Great. Thank you.
Dave.
Bye.
Thank you, guys.